Hello and welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Tonight we have two shows coming up for you. We'll start off with Forgotten History, and then move on to Let's Talk About Science. Enjoy!
Welcome to Forgotten History, and I'm your host, Isaac Bates, with your second host,
Jacob Clemmer.
And today we have a guest speaker. Anna, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey everyone, I'm Anna Da Silva. I'm a student here at AUP. I also make my own music. I've been doing music in Paris for the last 3 years under the artist name Anna Galilee.
What kind of music do you do?
I started off doing synth pop, and we've been segueing into indie rock.
Oh, wow. Okay. Do you know, you're on the show Forgotten History, so I'm assuming you know a lot of musical history that would be pretty, you know, uncommon knowledge to the regular person. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. This is definitely going to be like a VH1 behind the music moment for sure.
Oh, man. I'm excited then.
There we go.
Yeah, and like the world of music history, like, I know a lot about the history of the Beatles, and that's about it. Like, I imagine there's just so much there because there are so many genres, and each genre has like its own like heroes and like controversies throughout history. Am I right?
Yeah, of course, a lot of surprises too.
As far as my knowledge on like musical history, I just know like '80s, a lot of electric, you know, you get some like cheesy stuff and whatnot. And the '90s, you also have the cheesy stuff too, but a lot of like
grunge.
Rock. Yeah, you get that punk stuff, 2000s, and, you know, I just know, like, what took place in each era. That's pretty much it.
Absolutely, and it's also each era has its own style and its own kind of thing, you know. Every decade can be recognized by that. I just think that the last two decades, especially to the 2010s, has been a little interesting in the music world because it's not really a decade you can define with one specific thing.
Because it's like with like the internet, everyone can kind of like there's so many new genres that can like coexist at the same time with things like Spotify and SoundCloud, right?
Right, and styles aren't lasting 10 years now. They're also coming and going quickly.
Yeah, that's true. I remember like from 2012 to like 2015, we had that intense like mumble rap phase.
Right.
I mean, it's still here a little bit, but it was like...
It's pretty short-lived.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, it's still here, but yeah, that's just an example of what you're saying. Things come and go pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
I mean, the biggest musical moment for me in the 2010s, I love musicals. That's the other thing I know about musically. Like, Hamilton was like the biggest thing for like a year or two. I heard in like 3 high school classes. but now it feels very like from a different era just 5 years later.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting you say that. It feels so long ago, right?
Yeah. So what are we going to be talking about today exactly?
Well, we have a couple of things, but I wanted to touch upon how... Did you know, Isaac and Jacob?
I probably didn't.
Did you know? So in the 70s, right, if you take a look at it, I mean the rock bands that really, like, survived time, you know, that if you say any of their names today.
Pink Floyd.
Yeah, you know, you'll know who it is. They basically passed the third album test. And that basically is, like, every rock band that was signed, like in the 70s or so, they get a three-album deal.
Really?
And if you look back, usually their third album was their best album. And if you really take a look back and you do some research, you're gonna see time and time again that's kind of shown, because if they didn't get that third album cut, they didn't get it charted, it was over for them.
So they were, like, either saving up their best stuff, or they just, like, put in a huge amount of effort to the third album because, like, they need to, like, get through to
exactly.
the next contract.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You have, like, examples like Aerosmith. You have their first album released at, like, maybe, I don't know, number 21, and then their third album hits number 11 on the charts. It gives you Walk This Way, Sweet Emotion, like, crazy songs we still listen to today. And I don't know. I don't know if that's... I don't know how it is nowadays, you know, but that's how you get the most energy out of people, I think. And I think we're missing that.
So back then, pretty much what you're telling me is the third album was, like, the best. It was just...
Yeah.
It had all... Well, not all the hits, but it had most of the hits, probably.
It had a ton of
hits,
right?
Most significant.
Yeah.
Okay. But why was that exactly? I know you mentioned contracts and whatnot, but, like, why... Why not go big on, like, the first one, you know, get your name out there and go big on the second one because you got to follow up. And then, you know, after that, I mean, I don't quite understand it.
Well, you're already signed, right? You already got those three albums. Regardless of how well the first one's going to do, you're still going to get that second one. Regardless how well that's going to do, you still got that third one locked in.
That's true.
And it's hard to make a hit song. Some people, if they can do it, they're a one-hit wonder, and they got that one song. So to try to do that three times is insanely difficult. But then when you put in all that energy to that third album, that's when it just kind of skyrockets.
Well, it's kind of like coming up with a deadline, like, oh, shit, I got to really do well, or, like, I'm not passing this class.
Exactly. I don't know. Just imagine if you treated everything in your life like the third album kind of situation. I feel we would be superhumans. Like, we would be so successful in everything.
I feel like we'd also have a lot more heart attacks. Like, imagine, like, everything is going to be the end of your career.
You die young, but you die a legend.
So, okay, so what would happen with these rock bands that put out fourth or fifth albums where they kind of, it was just up to them how it went?
Well, there you go. So then it would, then they get the deals renewed. And then they kind of go crashing down, right? Which is actually a really good example of, like, what happened to, like, Aerosmith. Like, they're going great, you know, top of the world. All of a sudden, it's over kind of thing. Like, they're not making hits anymore. Then you get the guys at Run DMC randomly listening to Walk This Way, coincidentally, one of their third album songs. And they're like, man, we got to sample this. This is cool. They hit them up. They blended rock and rock, rap and a rock for the first time, like a freaking explosion, you know, in history, just like this cultural thing. And not only did that take Run DMC through the roof, that also, like, revived the entire career of Aerosmith and then just blew them up back in the 90s. How many bands can you say was enormous in the 70s? And then again in the 90s, like 20 years later, they even got their ride at Disney World. Like, I don't know.
I didn't know that.
It's a crazy thing. Yeah.
I actually never really listened to Aerosmith.
And
when it came to Run DMC, I only knew, like, the, you know, the super popular songs. I'd never really, like, the songs that would be in movies, you know.
You know, Run DMC is even in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised.
Which is interesting, though. Like, you know, even LL Cool J just got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, like, this year. And I don't know. What do you think about that blend? Like,
I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at this point is just expanding to all music at this point. Like, I mean, Run DMC was inducted by, like, Eminem, like, you know, the famous rock star, you know?
Yeah.
Well, he has a rock song, believe it or not. It's like Sing for the Moment, the Eminem version.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But like, they are they have diversified, I guess. But like, so like, do you think that like, why do you think people crash? Is it just because they like put all their, after their third album, is it just because they were like, are running out of ideas? Like, I've heard that like a lot of bands, they never get their like second album out. Like, they put all their effort into their first album and then they're like out of ideas. So like, for like maybe better acts, do they run out of ideas after the third album?
It's like really subjective. I mean, I might just say something, it could be controversial or what, but you know, kind of when you get to a level of success, especially back in that era, you're getting so much money overnight, kind of thing. People spend it on a lot of subjective things. You know, maybe they spend it on drugs and then they don't know how to control that, or they don't know how to control their finances. So now their life is kind of spiraling out of control, and that's affecting everything.
Do you also think it could be, because I notice this with a lot of bands, especially bands that are not very well known, they make a lot of good music. Maybe they have 1, 2, 3 albums that are really good, and then they become kind of mainstream, and their music is just like, you know, it's just not, they're not what they used to be. Do you think it could also be that they have this taste of success? Not even this taste, they've obtained success, and they feel like they don't have to work as hard because they've already made it. Maybe they've lost some creativity.
Well, at that point, I don't think they're actually them anymore. It's this artificial band. Like, they've started out originally how they were, but now you have all this interference with labels and outside writers. They're not even singing their own songs. You know, there's other people writing for them and other people producing everything. And at this point, they're almost like robots, and they just got to keep putting out what they're told to put out.
Yeah. Okay. Do you, this is off topic, but do you know anything behind, like, as far as the legal framework behind making music? Like, if you make a song, is that song actually yours? If you're signed to a record label, the record label, do they own, like, completely?
Yeah.
Like, do you know how that works exactly? Can you take a minute or two to explain that? I know it's very off topic, but.
Well, the thing is, like, again, every deal is subjective. Every contract is different. But, yeah, if it's kind of like the whole idea, I'd rather have a small percent of something than a large percent of nothing, right? If you make that song, if it gets to the hands of a label, if it actually gets into the hands of an artist, if it's going to be recorded, it's going to be in sync, you're probably likely going to own a very tiny percent of that song that you created all by yourself, kind of thing, because then they do involve other people in the project, and suddenly that percentage is cut up into a bunch of pieces of the pie, because that's what everyone wants. So yeah, there's a lot. It's a give and take. You know, you have to give a lot to get something.
Because you need them for like like when you're starting out, you need them to like market it and produce it and like.
Well, they're gonna.
And in
take
the
it
old
off.
Days, like put physical media out there.
Exactly. To actually get somewhere, you know.
For any listeners just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Forgotten History.
Okay. And so I know that there is a second or third topic you might have wanted to talk upon.
Sure.
Talk about.
Okay. Well, I have this really random story of when I used to work, let's just say, as a roadie, right, in concerts and stuff like that, I met Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I was kind of like fixing up his dressing room, and we got into a conversation, and he randomly told me, hey, did you know that Simon and Garfunkel recorded Global Warming? And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, in the song April Come She Will, they sing about the seasons. I don't know. I guess the song came out like in the 70s. I wish I could get you that number. But the point is that, you know, you have this lyric right here. Can I just like read it to you?
Yeah,
This is what he did to me. Okay, so you guys let me know if this works for you. This is literally it. He says, you know, April, when the streams are ripe and swelled with rain. Okay, it rains in April. And then it says June, she changes her tune. July, she will fly. And then August, die she must. The autumn winds blow chilly and cold. And he's saying that autumn is in August. Do you think autumn is in August?
In the song
today,
or in real life?
Right now. Is August summer or autumn
August
for you?
August is summer.
It's summer. See, summer officially ends, what, September
21st?
Yeah.
But that's what they're saying. Wait, why did they write August is autumn? So he's trying to say global warming. August is now warmer. So now you've got this kind of like a couple decades later. That's what he said, though.
I interpreted it slightly differently.
That's what he said, though. And I was
like
oh,
it was
wow.
colder in August, but I think it makes sense if he's saying like everything's kind of slide to the
Yeah, because
the left or the
because
right.
everything's getting, you know, yeah. warmer.
Yeah, the cycles are, you know, a different, they're longer.
I don't know if I buy that, but I will. But and it's not you. It's
no, I'm just repeating
Neil Tyson. But like,
no, don't quote me on Neil deGrasse Tyson.
But I will say, like, people, the scientific community was starting to learn about global warming in the 70s. Like Al Gore, who's like the like cheerleader of like doing stuff about global warming. Like he was going to Harvard. I read this in a class. He was going to Harvard, and there were like literal scientists who were studying the effects of like CO2. Like we had like the basic some scientists at Harvard. Literally had the basics of the idea at 70s, but I don't think Simon and Garfunkel went to Harvard.
They just recorded the season and what they felt outside, right?
It could just be for alliteration, like August and autumn, like it.
I don't know. I think maybe it was cold. Maybe
yeah.
It
maybe they. I to me it sounds like and who knows? Maybe they were very educated people, but to me it just sounds like they're trying to be kind of poetic, and it's the song.
Anything about the seasons is poetic. I feel.
Yeah.
I feel like in any case, we'll need to like Google.
We need to ask
the
them.
Temperature in 19. What was the temperature in 1970s in August on that day? You know, it's probably like recorded.
Oh, it's definitely
that's
there.
The only,
it's definitely
the
there. I mean, we got to find out where they recorded that song, you know?
And we got to make sure to ask them separately because, like, they don't. We're like, is Paul Simon even still alive?
Yeah, they're both alive.
Okay. I know that, like, Paul Simon is, like, a complete dick to Garfunkel.
Oh.
So we need to ask them separately. Like, literally, like, Paul Simon's, like, he's that guy who I sang with, and, like, I'm the best songwriter in, like, the 20th century. Like,
I mean,
they do not get along.
He is one of the best songwriters in the
he
20th
is,
century.
He is, but
were
like,
they,
that doesn't even have to be.
Were they doing drugs and stuff? Like,
of
were they?
Well,
were
it was the 60s.
Were they big?
It was the 60s.
But were they big, like, into the drugs?
I think they probably did. Because
that might skew.
There you go. That could be a limitation.
Yeah.
This is a total research
it's like,
assignment.
It's like Strawberry
right now.
Fields Forever isn't really about like agriculture.
Oh, jeez. But okay, well, that's really cool that he mentioned that. I feel like he definitely kind of put his own spin on those lyrics. That's
like
just my personal opinion, but who knows? Maybe they're ahead of their time and they're very educated and wanted to.
I mean, the fact that he said that itself is interesting. Like,
yeah. Do you know of any other songs that are trying to, that have tried to, I guess, raise awareness on the climate?
Oh, there's a ton of songs. Now, I don't know. Are they like top 10 Billboard hits? I don't know. I can't think of one. Can you?
I know. All I know is that song, We Are the World.
Oh, yeah, We Are the World.
But that's not really about the climate. That's like
about
getting along, right?
That's actually about raising money
for like Ethiopia, I think it was. Or is it Bangladesh? One of the two.
I've never actually heard that song. From start to finish, I just.
Oh really? Oh, have you seen the recording session videos? Oh my goodness,
yeah,
it's hilarious.
Some people try to like outdo each other.
And
right?
I saw like Bob Dylan. He is so not feeling it.
Oh,
like
some
of his friends clearly dragged them in there.
Have you seen them? Michael Jackson the whole time, especially when someone's going off key. The amount of shade. I invite you to go back and look at the recording sessions of this. It's the most incredible thing. Of like what the camera didn't put in the official video, you know. There's so many.
I know exactly what you're talking
there's
about.
There's shade everywhere. Yeah.
There's like some guy he adds like 20 additional notes when there shouldn't be, and then.
Oh, that was
Michael
Huey Lewis. Yeah.
Michael Jackson is just behind him. Like, what is going on?
Yeah. Oh man, but you know, when's the last time something like that happened too? I don't know.
When they got like everyone together for something. I don't know. It's been a while.
Oh, I know. The Gal Gadot video.
Yeah. I hope that becomes front in history, please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, that doesn't count because they weren't in one spot. Like, Doesn't count if it's on the internet, I don't think.
Yeah, and they're not all artists, you know. They're it was mainly actors, right?
It was John Legend was in there.
I saw Sarah Silverman, comedian, and I think Aaron Paul.
Yeah.
From Breaking Bad.
I don't think I got that far into the video.
Yeah.
He's talking like Batman for some reason. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, man. But those, and then that reminds me of if you Google, like, in that. Okay, so after We Are the World, that was really successful. There was like the metal version. But you gotta, but they're all trying to outdo each other, but like metal wise, like all these giant hair band people. That one's worth, if you're listening right now, just Google. We Are the World metal version, and you're welcome. That's going to be the most entertaining 5 minutes of your life for
nice.
For that moment.
So you as an artist, I know that we've kind of covered these topics already, but we do have a few minutes, so I would like to expand upon what you do, you know, not to like advertise you or anything, but like what kind of music inspires you? What were you listening to? I know you're saying you're doing indie rock now, or you're branching out to it, but, you know, what kind of music did you grow up on? Do you like?
Well, I kind of grew up actually listening just to the Bee Gees for a really long time. When I was, like, a kid, I don't know, we found this, like, Bee Gees number one album at Best Buy.
I love the Bee Gees.
Oh, my God, yeah. So, you know, we just play that in every road trip. I ended up learning how to sing, like, Barry Gibb. If you want to,
wow.
Do you want a sample of that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're asking, if you want to put that out there, go ahead.
Okay, give me a Bee Gees song.
More Than a Woman.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I love that song, by the way. But it's like, more than a woman, more than a woman to me. Girl, I know you're very well. You gotta put it in there. You put it up there. I love it. But you know what's so funny? I actually incorporate that. And backup vocals in my own recordings. Because whenever I'm recording my own songs, I do my own backup vocals. And we do 20 layers. And you got to do, like, a deep bass. You got to do, like, that high pitch kind of thing. And you got to do, like, that little girl in the corner. And that turns into a beautiful choir. But I've been doing that. So I've been listening to a lot of Bee Gees. And I grew up a lot with, like, classic rock. A lot of Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses. And then, like, random 80s. Like Duran Duran, like a lot of Duran Duran, Tears for Fears, and all these styles that just have been really inspiring me for forever, blended into this kind of, I could say, if I could describe my music, it's kind of something that puts you into a mindset for a while, for 3 minutes, kind of puts you into like another realm, another planet of lo-fi, indie rock, synth pop vibes.
Okay. Yeah. Do you listen to any, like, Weezer, anything like that?
Yeah, I love Weezer. What's his name again? The guy? Come on. It's escaping me. Well, he went to my college.
One of the singers?
The lead singer of Weezer, yeah.
I don't know his name, but...
Yeah, he's so dope. Such a dope guy. But yeah, grew up with a lot of, like, you know, you can't deny... If you didn't grow up with Beverly Hills and Who Let the Dogs Out, did you have a childhood, you know?
Oh, I mean, that song was everywhere when I was, like 6, 7,
That was
eight.
A one-hit wonder, Who Let the Dogs Out.
Well, then, okay, so
But Beverly Hills, yeah, great, great song. I also liked Island in the Sun, another great one.
Okay. First of all, just to be clear, we know Weezer did not release Who Let the Dogs Out, just for context.
Oh, yeah.
That was Bahamut.
What other songs were like big? What is that song? Why can't I think of her name right now? It goes, you know, it's super popular even today.
Well, sing it. Sing it for us, Isaac. Oh, Kylie Minogue?
Yes. Yeah. Can't Get You Out of My Head. That was another one I was hearing.
That's in the 90s.
I was always hearing. Yeah, I know, but like.
How old are you, Isaac? Up, are you secretly older?
Certain songs.
I was
like,
born in the 90s.
Me too.
I wasn't. Certain songs like come back though at weird times.
Yeah.
And like for whatever reason, like Blitzkrieg Pop was in like the Jimmy Neutron movie.
Yeah.
And so like that song is like burned into my brain as like being associated with like 2007
or
whatever.
Well, that was played all the time on like some cell phone commercial. I don't know if you saw those, but it was like the theme song for like Verizon or something.
Oh yeah,
for
I can believe it.
For me, that's, you know, All Star by Smash Mouth. That's forever like the Shrek song for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A good song.
Yeah.
like I can't I want to hate it, but I can't.
There's no way. And this new Shrek meme wave that keeps surging in and out, I don't know if you guys know about this.
We need a guest speaker to talk about the history of memes sometime.
Yes, you do.
Like,
I don't know who that would be. Who would be qualified for that, but
so, like,
we'll
where, I don't know if this is, like, on topic, but, like, where do you see, like, the future of music as going? Because, like, one thing that I was browsing Wikipedia one night, and, like, one thing that, like, it mentioned was, like, the era of albums is, like, from, like, 1950 to, like, 2012 or something. Because now no one listens to, like, albums anymore. Like, it's all, like, playlists or, like, people just release a single.
Yeah.
Like, where do you see, like, music as going? Do you think it just becomes more and more, like, niche and everyone just has their own, like... subgenre?
Well, you know, like, playlists are almost like the new album, you know, that's the deal. And people are consuming content at such a rapid rate that, you know, to even get an album out takes a couple of years, and you got to constantly keep putting stuff out. I don't know, that's a great question.
And, like,
you know?
People like the other thing about albums, like, if you listen to older albums, there's a lot of filler on, like, stuff from, like, the 60s or the 70s. Like, on great albums, there'll just be, like, a couple of songs that are complete duds, but they're just trying to pad it. And, like, these days, no one wants filler.
Well, that's because that's the whole point, right? You have the album. The whole point is to get that single on the A side, and then you put the filler songs on the B sides because everyone got the album deals. And nowadays, it's just hit after hit because you're getting all these outside writers. But we need to go back to making organic music again. And I think rock is coming back, you know, like, a lot of – it's coming back in a lo-fi kind of form. But I think as soon as that quality comes back, and when I say quality, I'm not trying to step on any writer of anything that just because it's mainstream doesn't mean it's good. It's actually great. It's fantastic. That's why it charted. But going back to those organic roots of having those five people in the room who write their own songs for the whole album.
Get,
like,
their ideas the old fashioned way by doing drugs.
Well, you don't have to do drugs to, you know, be creative.
Or going through some traumatizing event or having some crazy messed up childhood or something.
Hey, I would say 2020 was pretty traumatizing. So.
Yeah, there's trauma going to go around.
Yeah. Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate you bringing
your great to have you.
Thanks
taster,
for having me, you guys.
All right. And that's going to conclude our episode of Forgotten History. Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, so welcome to Let's Talk About Science. I'm Morgan,
and I'm here with Nicole. And today we're going to talk about more science. So I'm talking specifically about a study from 1964. And this has popped up recently because there's been a new study that's been floating around social media that's relatively similar, but it has a bit of controversy. So I'm going back to the original one because I still think it's applicable and people don't actually know about it, even though it's been done, 60 years ago. This is by Stanley Wechkin, Jules Masterman, and William Terrace Jr. at Northwestern University Medical School. And basically, it found that it studied rhesus monkeys, so a specific type of monkey that are generally the same body type, and found that they will avoid eating if it subjects another monkey to electric shock. So it's super sacrificial behavior, and monkeys will sacrifice food if it means that it might hurt another monkey. Which is particularly interesting. So essentially, they kept monkeys for a year in cages, three to a cage, and taught them using red and blue stimulus lights to get food pellets, basically, by pulling like particular levers and chains. And they were given like 1 hour sessions to figure this out and over time until they were able to do it with 90% accuracy and no more than, I think it was 25 or something in a minimum of 50 trials, missed unsignaled pulls. But essentially, yeah, they were tested. And the sessions were quite interesting because before the session, they were left for 22 hours without food. So super hungry and tested in 90-minute intervals. This was stopped if they were unresponsive for 5 minutes. So very extreme, almost an extreme study feeling, or seemingly. And so essentially, once they were getting above 90%, success rates, they actually did a more official test where they paired monkeys together and forced them to compete against one another for grapes to test dominance levels and see which monkeys were the highest on the dominance chain, which were the lowest on the dominance chain, to see if they maybe when they end up doing the final test about food, if it's based on they give up food for those that they feel are dominant, if they're afraid of them, or if they're more submissive, they maybe are more inclined to do it. But in fact, they found that it had no effect, the dominance levels, any of the hierarchy. Okay. So essentially, they paired a hungry monkey with one that would be shocked in the experiment. And then they reversed the roles in the second test period to see if there's any difference between monkeys when they were shocked in the first one, if they were more inclined to not shock the other monkey in the second time, or if they had never been shocked, maybe they were more inclined to choose the food and all of these different things. And the shock was about 5 milliamps, which for context, 10 can paralyze or freeze muscles. So 5 is painful, but not unreal, I suppose, or not dangerous, lethal to some extent. And essentially, they found that animals were less inclined to shock the other monkey if they had been shocked before, and more inclined for those who they were cage mates with. So the monkeys that they knew better, they were more inclined to protect. And some went an average of 7.5 days without food, as compared to like a day and a half for those who had never received a shock. So if they had received the shock, they would go about 7.5 days on average without eating to protect the other monkey from eating or from being shocked.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah. So an unreal study. This was done about 60 years ago, so certainly not new, but it's popping up more recently to talk about
you know, are people innately good? Are they innately bad? Do people protect others? Especially with this new mask debate, are people willing to protect others, and to what lengths will they go?
What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think the monkeys could feel when the other monkeys were feeling the pain somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they see it, or did they feel it, or they were feeling the pain, so they wouldn't want to inflict the pain.
Yeah. And it had nothing to do with dominance. It wasn't because they were afraid of the monkeys. It wasn't because they looked up to them. It was just, this monkey's experiencing pain. I've felt the shock. I know what it feels like. And if it means I have to go 7.5 days without eating, I'm going to protect this monkey.
Well, I think we can feel each other. Everyone can feel everyone. And sometimes if you're closer to someone, you give them more of your presence. You give them more of your focus. But you could still feel the pain of a stranger. In the city, it's constant. You kind of have to close, and it hurts because you see people on the street and you feel their pain, but you can't always do. Well, we think we can't do anything about it, but it's hard, right?
Yeah.
It still hurts, and I don't know what this is. It's something in us animals. It's like a mutual understanding, maybe to keep the pack healthy.
Yeah.
Do you ever hang out with horses or
No, animals? I don't know anything about horses, but animals, of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're intuitive. But what does that even mean? Intuitive.
I'm not sure.
It's hard to define scientifically.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Let's Talk About Science.
It's interesting. It's interesting considering in the middle of this pandemic, you know, people are fighting to wear a piece of cloth on their face that would protect other people. And you almost feel like these monkeys are going 8 days without eating to protect somebody else in some circumstances. And we can't wear a cloth on our face or a piece of paper or a mask. You know what I'm trying to say?
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea.
Well, maybe if someone saw somebody sick in the hospital with the disease and they felt it, they would make a change. But when we just hear facts or get news and we're distanced from it, the brain doesn't always have the same amount of empathy. Some people do.
Yeah.
Some people don't. But when you see someone in pain, it's really hard to turn away.
I mean, what about walking down the street and you see homeless people? I mean, to what extent are we ignoring, are we just ignoring it right in front of our faces, you know?
Yeah. Well, the question is, what can you do in that moment?
Yeah.
I think it does hurt to turn away from people.
Yeah.
But I tend, in the city, when you're constantly asked for money on the street, personally, I don't give any money.
I do. I do. And not to say that that's better or worse, because, you know, they say actually giving to resources and support systems is better. Mm. I didn't when I lived in New York, because I felt like, I don't know, I didn't feel, I don't know what changed. But when I moved here, now I try to always do something. I've convinced myself that good karma, bad karma. I don't know if this is true, but...
It's a beautiful thing to just face the person and treat them like a human.
Yeah.
50 cents or a euro is what else are you going to spend it on?
Yeah.
Really, we can let go of it.
Yeah.
It's okay, but...
I don't know. In my head, it seems... I feel like, you know, you hear about these things like Joe Biden's infrastructure bill or all of these things where you're hearing $50 million is going to this or $100 million or $1 billion to that or whatever it is, and you hear these huge, huge money amounts. But I think we don't think about what is the, like, actual real-world application of this, and when it's spread among so many people, what actual impact is it having? And just seeing somebody's face when you give them, you know, you buy them something to eat if they look hungry or whatever it is, I think, I don't know if this is true, but in my head it has more impact than other situations. You know, there's a good Netflix show, actually, that I just started watching. It's called Made. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
I think this, too, is like a big push for me, because I think you forget how when you're down, you're like down, down, and you need just somebody to help you. Even if it's something small, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I think what you're saying, treating people as humans with dignity, without judgment, is a big gift. And a few euros is another gift. And it's just an interaction, a presence. And I do believe that healing work is all about being present in the moment. And most of our time, we're going fast, we're speeding up, and that takes us away from being here right now, which is why I like this radio, because we're here right now just talking, and it's slowing down into the present moment, and it's what we can do as humans, but it's also what we can do as animals. And actually, I saw a documentary film this week, and it was called Animal, and it was about climate change and the environment. But it was looking at humans as animals, and it talked a lot about how animals are intelligent creatures, which should be obvious, but it's taken a long time for many people in science even to realize that animals have intelligence and emotions. And, you know, Jane Goodall was one of the first people to say this.
I mean, but even still, I have a statistic that's pulled up right in front of me that I was thinking about as I was reading this, but about the cruelty of animal testing, right? I mean, we've learned something really amazing from this study, but to do it, you had to starve monkeys for 7 days. So to what extent is it worth it? To what extent does it even make any sense? And it's actually banned in, I think, 29 countries as of a couple years ago, but right now it says annual number of animals used in research testing in countries worldwide as of 2020. This was published in October of this year. And in fact, it's 20 million in the United States that's still used in annually in experiments.
It's horrifying.
China's 16 million. Japan is 11 million. The EU is 9.4 million, despite it being seemingly illegal. I mean, all of these different things. This is from the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty of Animals, but I mean, you think.
Well, I'm looking at it kind of from a meta perspective of, okay, let's do a study of why white male scientists want to do this study on poor rhesus monkeys.
Yeah.
Like, let's study these male scientists.
Yes.
Like, why are they? What is their motivation?
And how do you come up with an experiment like this where you're willing to, I mean, I don't know.
And it's justified by the scientific method, but we should always be able to deconstruct.
Am I the only one that thinks about ape uprisings? Like just
no.
Them like getting pissed and being like, you know what? I'm not going to get starved for 22 hours for you to understand something about human nature or animal nature.
It's a paradox. It's like,
oh my God.
Of course we have feelings. Why do you have to
honestly
torture us to find
to
out?
To understand this, yeah.
Well, no, there's many people who you could join to free the animals. What is it? The Animal Liberation Front.
I'm sure.
They go in and free the animals. But then these animals need to go somewhere protecting them. But anyway, there's a lot of work to be done. And animals are amazing. And I really want to spend more time with animals. So we must share time with animals and each other. But nature is very important for us. Is that the message? What is the message today?
I nature. Don't know. The message, I don't know. Human nature, people, animal nature, all of these things, right?
Compassion or empathy.
Compassion, empathy. It's interesting in a study about empathy how little empathy there is.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
I think you could write a very good article or
about
paper
this.
About that.
Yeah.
So why did they who are these people who did this study?
Yeah.
And how did they feel putting other beings through this to prove that they had empathy?
Yeah.
And also prove that the scientists were monsters?
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, it is such a dichotomy to look at animals going 7 days without eating to protect other animals while they're being forced into these situations by humans. I mean,
interesting. This is very interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
And it shows you that whatever system that we're in is very disconnected. In order to progress, to write a paper, to get a study funded, people are elevated for being like disconnected from these really beautiful things like empathy and compassion. Like the more you disconnect, the more successful you'll kind of be.
I think
don't do it.
did you watch Squid Games?
I really don't know what it's about.
So I had avoided it until last week somehow because I was like, oh, everybody was watching it. I'm not doing that. but in fact, I actually watched it last week, and I think maybe that's part of the reason that I've gone. So that my first thought is like, what the hell is going on? But it's really interesting about human behavior. If you you should definitely watch it. I think it actually was worth the hype and very fabulous. But yeah, I mean, my goodness, all of this is...
Well, let's talk about science, Morgan. We have to wrap it up. But do you have any closing statements?
No.
Or thoughts about this week? Like, what's going on with you? What's going on with Paris?
I don't know what is in the air this week, but I feel like everyone is exhausted, and I'm feeling it for sure. But everything is good. Thank you guys for listening to me talk about science, if anybody is listening. And otherwise, thank you for talking to me about science. Yeah, this is...
Can't wait to talk about science next week.
This is the highlight of my week, actually.
You have some cool articles coming next week.
Yes.
Very current.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Next week, we'll talk about masks and what people think about seeing somebody's face when they've only known them behind the face of a mask.
I've only seen Morgan's eyes.
And I know I took my mask off earlier, and she was like, whoa. The equivalent of, you could just put that right back on. We don't have to do this. And I guess I wonder if it's the same when you just hear our voices, you know? What do you think?
You'll have to write us.
Well, thank you guys for listening to us talk about science.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 29th episode of the semester. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicate Studios. Enjoy your night.